אתם מאזינים לספריית הפודקאסטים של רדיו תל אביב.
הדודים מאמריקה עם שירה רודרמן, הפודקאסט על יהודי ארצות הברית וישראל.
שלום מאזינים ומאזינות, כאן שירה רודרמן בפודקאסט הדודים מאמריקה, הפודקאסט של קרן משפחת רודרמן ברדיו תל אביב. בכל פרק נעסוק בסיפור המרתק של הקשר בין ישראל ליהדות ארצות הברית דרך שיחות עומק עם דמויות מובילות מעולמות התרבות, הכלכלה, התקשורת והחברה. והיום נארח כאן איש יקר, חבר יקר, דוקטור לארי באקאו, הנשיא לשעבר של אוניברסיטת הרווארד. תודה, לארי. Thank you very much that you're with us.
It's delighted a special to be here with you. Thank you for the opportunity.
It is a special conversation today because this podcast is usually in Hebrew, and today we are asking our listeners to bear with us and to have, I think, a very unique conversation with someone that is dear to the Jewish people, to the Jewish community, and of course to the society in the United States. So really, really thank you for being with us. For those that don't know everything about you, and there is so much to say to present you, I think it will be important to mention your last position as the former president of Harvard University. You were also the president of Tufts University, which would be very much connected to our conversation about the challenges in the academia in the United States and the conversation about Israel and the Jewish community within the academic world. So if it's, before we jump into these important big topics, it is hard to skip, I think, the personal story, which you are a son of a Holocaust survivor that has a great impact, if I may say, about your identity, your story, who you are as a person, as a father, as a professor, as a president, and a manager. Can you tell us a little bit about this background of yours? How did it shape you?
Sure. Well, first of all, again, Shira, thank you very much for the opportunity to participate today. And thank you to your listeners for indulging me, because this would be a very short interview if it were conducted in Hebrew. Both of my parents came to this country as immigrants. Both came as refugees. My father was born in Minsk. He came before the war. He actually was a child when they came, but they came to escape the pogroms in Eastern Europe. My mother was born and raised in Germany in a small town, Lundorf, which is about an hour from Frankfurt. Sadly, she was deported along with all the other residents of her town and the surrounding villages on the same day, September 14th, 1942, to the concentration camps. There were about 120 Jews who were on that train. My mother was the only one who survived. Her family spent the first 2 years in Theresienstadt and then were transported to Auschwitz, where she was separated from her parents. Her sister had been detained earlier, she thought that her sister might have survived the war. It turned out she died in the first ship transport of Jews to Auschwitz in 1942. My mother was in Auschwitz for about 3 weeks because she was still young enough and healthy enough to work. She was transported then to a slave labor camp in Meersdorf, where she was liberated by the Russians at the end of the war. I've often said, where else in the world can you go literally in one generation from off the boat with nothing? That was the case for both of my parents, but especially my mother, who came to this country on the second Liberty ship, troop ship, that brought refugees from Europe after World War II. She had an aunt and uncle that had left Germany in 1938 and come to the States. It's a long story, but eventually she made contact with them and then was able to come to the States, where she met my father after the war.
How did it shape who you are as a person, who you are as an academic?
Well, in a number of ways. Even before I became an academic, I always knew that my mother had been in the camps. I knew that she had survived Auschwitz, and I knew that she had lost her whole family. her aunt and uncle were like my grandparents on my mother's side, but essentially I had almost no other family on my mom's side, except for a few distant cousins who, again, who had left Germany before the war. My mother was very unusual, however, in that she never conveyed or burdened my sister or myself with the generational trauma that is so often a gift, if you will, of victims of the Holocaust to their children. My mother was optimistic. She was forward-looking. She was fun. She was enthusiastic. She encouraged me to take risks. She used to say, when I would worry about something, what's the worst that can happen? Can you live with that? Then why worry? And of course, my mother had seen the worst that could happen. So, I had an incredibly normal childhood, but I also grew up with a very, very strong Jewish identity. We lived in a modest-sized town, Pontiac, Michigan, a gritty industrial town, home of three General Motors automobile plants. It had a modest-sized Jewish community. There was a synagogue and a Reform temple, one split off from the other, as is typical. But life revolved around the synagogue for me. The major service in our synagogue was on Friday night. Saturday morning was junior congregation, where we went to learn the Shabbat morning prayers. Sunday was Sunday school, and then Hebrew school was either Monday, Wednesday, or Tuesday, Thursday. So 5 days a week I was at the synagogue.
So Jewish
And
identity was your daily practice. And would
yes.
you say that this shaped in many ways the type of professional you chose to be?
Well, yes, in that, I was always extremely conscious of the fact that I was Jewish, Yiddish was my father's first language, German, my mother's. German Jews didn't speak Yiddish. She learned how to speak it. When we would go visit my father's parents every Sunday, Yiddish was what would be spoken. Eventually, I came to understand Yiddish quite well. I've lost some of it now, but I was always extremely cognizant of my Jewish identity. I never used to talk about my mother until I became president of Harvard.
I read the story, but I want to emphasize, why am I asking so much about the Jewish element in your identity? It leads me to today's reality, and I wonder, for someone that has truly the best perspective of the younger generation and academia, and you are also economics major, like your ability to see it from so many lenses, I wonder if part of the challenge that we're experiencing today in America, in Israel, in the Jewish world, has something to do with a lack of strong values, identity. Do we understand our history in order to be good people, good citizens of today, and shape future changes?
It's a really good question, Shira. I think that the younger generation of Jews in the United States do not have the same deep attachment to Israel that many of us did growing up. I recall vividly being glued to my TV with my parents during the 68 war. I was a junior in high school in 1968. It was very much a part of my experience. In 1964, my family traveled to Israel for my bar mitzvah, as part of my bar mitzvah. So I grew up with a very strong Jewish identity. I mean, we did all the things people did in those days. We had the blue and white tzedakah box in the kitchen. We bought trees to celebrate every kind of simcha. We gave Israel bonds as gifts when people had their bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. It's what we did. I think, and our kids, my own children, spent time in Israel when they were in high school. We sent them to Israel.
But what drives the connection? Is it Israel to your Jewish identity, or your Jewish identity to Israel?
Yes. I don't think you can, at least for people in my generation, I think it's hard to separate them. We also, my first sabbatical was in Israel in 1984. We spent 6 months living in Jerusalem. I was a faculty member at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem at the law school. I'm both a lawyer and an economist, so that time I was at the law school. And I continued to do work in Israel for a while after that, working with the Israeli government on a variety of things.
Excuse me.
So, my connection to Israel is quite strong. We've been back many, many times.
But how we
I
deal
but I
with
think
today's
again, this
reality?
younger generation does not have the same connection that we did. And partly they've grown up at a time in which Israel's position in the world has been contested in ways that it wasn't when I was growing up. Israel was the underdog. It succeeded in pushing back against those that would seek to destroy it and was greatly admired in the United States. And I think that the corrosive effect of the continued strife in the West Bank, the contested issues in the West Bank have festered, and I think it's caused deep divisions in Israel, as it has in the United States, over Israel's treatment of the Palestinians, the issue of settlements.
So you think that the
I took it,
political
I'm sorry.
sphere, the political atmosphere, and some of the policy that Israel had over the years changed the impact and the identity and the narrative among the younger generation to identify with either the Jewish identity and with Israel?
I think that the younger generation in many cases has only known strife. And that's not the case for the rest of us.
That's very, very important. And maybe I'll emphasize it, what you're saying also in translation, that what our kids know, that's what define a big part of who they are and their choices of the values. Well, I think that's a very interesting and important point of view that we, maybe as Israelis, don't always see the impact of it on people and Jews living outside of Israel. I'm interested to take you for a moment to the world of academia. The United States is in tremendous changes in the last few years, domestically, from a political point of view, to many other, to values, to vision, to not having unified agreement on maybe any topic in society. And I'm curious, as someone that studied in the United States, was in the positions that you were as a professor, as a researcher, as a president of two distinguished universities, can you teach us, first of all, what is the difference between the Israeli academia, the role of academia maybe, in the Israeli society versus American society? And then we'll take it to the changes over the years.
I'm not sure I can put my finger on the differences between the role that academia plays in Israeli society and American society. In the US, for years, we've always encouraged every student to go to college. That it's been traditionally, as I like to say, an escalator, which in one generation is capable of projecting students who came from exceedingly modest means, in many cases, up into the higher reaches of society. It has been an enabler of the American dream. This notion that you can come to this country and through hard work, there's opportunity for everybody, and higher education enables that. We've had some structural changes in our economy, which have, I think, called that into question. Traditionally in the US, the probability that a child would do better than their parents economically was almost taken for granted. If you take a look at the probability that a child would be economically better off than their parents were, let's say 10, 15, 20 years after they graduated from high school, the odds were 90%. It's been declining continuously for the last 50 years. And now it's about 50% the odds that children will do better than their parents. And so I think in a world in which parents will work their fingers to the bone in order to ensure that their children have a better life than they are, when you take that off the table, I think much a lot changes. And since higher education has been the traditional route for accomplishing that, I mean, again, I'm a good example. One generation to go from nothing to become president of Harvard. When that ceases to happen, I think people raise a lot of questions about higher education, at least in the United States. So I think that's what's happened in the US. I don't hold myself out as an expert in terms of how higher education has changed in Israel. I
I
leave that for the
didn't.
Israelis.
So maybe just to not the changes, it's the play that academia, the role that academia plays in certain Western societies and in the United States in particular, is significant. And as you said, economy change and structure change, but I'm also wondering if other things change within academia. Did we
Well,
lose the
yeah, elite has become
perspective?
a dirty word in the United States. People have been skeptical, have grown skeptical of elites, whereas they used to look up to them. But I also think that that has to do with some structural changes in the economy in the United States, as well. And in many ways, my hometown is a wonderful example of that. Pontiac, growing up, was a very relatively prosperous place. You could graduate from high school on a Monday and go to work in one of the automobile plants the next day and pretty much be guaranteed a comfortable middle-class life existence over time. Those plants have closed. Pontiac is the population went from 80,000 to 45,000. The town went through bankruptcy, receivership. All three of the public schools I attended in Pontiac have closed.
So how?
And much of this is being attributed to globalization, to trade, which, was pushed, advocated for, by the elites, not just in the United States, but throughout the world, that free trade was a good idea. But it resulted in lots of people losing their jobs. And so there's been, I think people now have questioned the role of institutions like elite higher education institutions, which not only the scholarship for that underlay some of these policies was done in these institutions, but many of the leaders of our country came from these institutions. And
True.
so there's now, I think, a reaction against
So
them.
there are two major things I want to ask you about the institutions and the academia. First of all, the cost. I mean, I read a lot about your past policies and the things that you personally were, pushing, not just in Harvard, but definitely as a president of two universities. The cost today, as a mother of four kids, three of them in college, it is absolutely insane. And I'm thinking about an average family that would like to raise kids that are going to good schools. It doesn't have to be all Ivy League schools. How is it possible with a tuition that is so not easy to pay? And we're talking about, and the reason I'm asking, it's not just to say, okay, cost of living is going up, is to say America stood for many years about equality and opportunities to everyone. And just by that, the equality and the opportunities are minimizing.
So I would say a couple of things. Again, it's a complicated question. We could spend hours just discussing this issue. First, at many institutions, including all the institutions I've been at, I've spent my entire career at three institutions: MIT, where I spent the first 24 years of my career, then 10 years at Tufts, and 12 years at Harvard. Each of them offer extraordinarily generous financial aid. So, if you are a student who comes from a family with less than $200,000 a year in income, you go to Harvard, you go to MIT tuition free. You pay no tuition. And if you come from a family at both of those institutions with family income substantially less than that, but still higher than the median family income in the United States. Median family income in the US is about $75,000 a year. You go absolutely free, not just tuition free, tuition, room, board, books, fees, transportation, computer, a warm coat if you need it. Everything is free. So these institutions have, yes, they are expensive, but they've made generous financial aid available to ensure that the, you know, that not just poor students, but middle-class students can attend them. For those in a position who are above that income, yes, it is expensive. But there are many places to get a good education in the United States. Now, having said that, what also happened as a result of the great financial crisis in 2008 is that the United States disinvested in supporting its great state institutions. I grew up in Michigan. University of Michigan is one of the best universities in the country. Mm-hmm. And traditionally, as I said, you could go to the University of Michigan, it costs very, very little. The reason it costs very little is that it was subsidized by the taxpayer. And during the financial crisis, this state support was greatly diminished. So there was a time in which over 50% of the budget of the University of Michigan, I'll just use that as an example, came from the state of Michigan. Today, that number is down around 10%. So the money, it's not as if the costs went away. The burden was shifted from the taxpayer, if you will, to the students and their families. So there are a variety of reasons why tuition rent went up. And then there are more technical reasons that have to do with the fact that in any industry in which there's not real productivity growth, costs are going to rise faster than inflation. It's true for universities. It's true for opera and theater tickets. It's true actually for tickets to sporting events.
But education,
they've all gone up
it's
faster
true.
Than inflation.
Of course,
and
I think
this is the case here as well.
It's true. But I think, as you said, what I take from, I think the important explanation is that yes, cost goes up, but we need to understand that it's coming from policies and not just from the growth of cost of living. And I think that's a very important clarification,
yes.
Because for those of us that are less familiar with the American system, we all look up to the American Academy, you know, the academia in the United States, but we don't always understand how things work and what does it mean. So I want to take you
right.
to today's reality. Today's reality, there are, in the last 3 years, I think, or if I add even COVID, tremendous challenges on campuses, from foreign fundings, anti-Semitism, to the DEI diversity, to so many issues that students deal with today. Please help me to understand, from a Jewish perspective, for the Jewish students, first of all, why the Jewish issues are much higher, I call it, on the scale of importance, higher. And you know what, excuse me, I'll rephrase my question, say, Jewish students suffering or experiencing more as a result of the issues that I mentioned than the average student. Can you please help me to understand the challenges?
Yeah, well, you know, Shira, I think, first of all, as we all know, anti-Semitism is on the rise in the world. It's on the rise in the United States. And it's on the rise on college campuses in the United States as well. We're a microcosm of the world that we live in. So in that respect, it's not surprising. Okay, that doesn't mean it. We don't need to combat it or push back against it. What I think is sometimes lost in the conversation is the fact that we have thriving Jewish communities on these campuses. When I left Harvard and you know, when I stepped down as president in 2023, both Hillel and Chabad were in the process of expanding their buildings, their footprint, to meet the increasing demand from students for Jewish programming. So it's also the case that you have, I was not the only Jewish president in the Ivy League. Early in my tenure, for the first 3 years of my presidency, or 2 years of my presidency, the presidents of Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, Penn, Cornell, and then I would add what's called the Ivy Plus Group, MIT, and the University of Chicago, we were all Jewish. We were too short of a minion. So it's not as if the leadership was indifferent to these issues, far from it. Moreover, I don't think we had institutionalized anti-Semitism, as some have claimed. If that were the case, you wouldn't have had all of us leading these institutions. And you know, I had everybody knew the president's house at Harvard was a kosher home. Adele and I keep kosher. I always had an aliyah on the high holidays at services at Hillel. That was true at Tufts as well. But so I say this because I think it's a mistake to think that Jews lived in or in fear on American college campuses. After October 7th, you saw an increase in anti-Semitism throughout the world, and you saw it on college campuses as well, as students in many cases rallied as they sought to defend what they perceived as the oppressed, the Palestinians. What was challenging about that, candidly, and continues to be, is that if you take a look at those students who were protesting in defense of the Palestinian, there was a significant number of them who were Jewish students as well, who were Jewish. And that made it very difficult to characterize every protest as anti-Semitic. So
Very, very
again, it's more
important.
complicated than it may appear from a distance if you look at it up close, and personal.
Absolutely, that we Jews are very known to challenge ourselves and make it more complicated. So in closing, I want to ask you two things, but the numbers of the percentage over the years for Jewish students is going down in certain universities, and if I use the institution I think you know probably best, is I read the numbers from 20% or 25% in Harvard. We're talking in the last couple of years to 4 to 5%. That says something about the changes within the institutions.
So there are a number of, again, now I'm going to sound like the economist that I am. I used to teach statistics at one point in my life. One of the things that's happened is that when we do surveys like this, now the largest religious group in terms of identification is none of the above. So, close to 40 to 50% of students do not claim any affiliation with any religious group at all. So if you take a look at the numbers for almost any religious group on campus, they've all fallen, okay, in terms of the proportion of the student body that is fill in the blank, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Catholic. They've all fallen because students these days, in many cases, in large numbers, do not identify with any religious organization.
So it's not necessarily that there's less Jews. You're saying it's the way they identify themselves.
That's part of it. The second thing is what we've done to ourselves. And that is, at least in the United States, the numbers are stunning if you take the Orthodox out of the equation. I think you probably know them as well. Something like 60 to 70%
Students.
of non-Orthodox Jews marry outside the faith.
Yes.
All right? And what about their children? Do they identify as Jewish or not? Well, some do and some don't. But this also accounts for the fact that we have a decline in the number of students who are identifying as Jewish. Now, that said, I go back to what I said earlier. We still have thriving Jewish communities on these campuses. And the fact that, again, Hillel and Chabad were both expanding their physical footprint because there was a great demand for increased Jewish programming, I think speaks to that as well.
I have so many more questions to ask you and so many topics that I would love to explore with you, but please leave us with a thought. What do you see as the biggest challenge for American Jews in the future, in this coming future?
I think the biggest challenge for American Jews is how we bring up the next generation of Jews in this country. How do we instill the values? I think we need to look in the mirror and ask ourselves, what are we doing to ensure that our children and our grandchildren have the same kind of strong Jewish identity, have the same kind of connection to Israel that many of us did, or most of us did, growing up? I think that's the biggest challenge for Jewry in the United States today.
Are you optimistic when you think about the future of Jews in the United States?
I am, because I think, like my mother, we are a resilient people. You know, here we are celebrating Hanukkah. And, you know, the Maccabees, just yet another example of the world trying to destroy Jewry and Judaism as we know it. And, you know, I think I always, whenever I gave a speech at Harvard or at Tufts, I always tried to incorporate into it some Jewish learning and teachings. And I did so because I think the teachings of our faith are too important to keep to ourselves. And actually, many of them really resonate with younger people today. You know, the notion of tikkun olam. You know, I would say to students, I would say to others, that I've yet to meet anybody who believes that the world that we live in is perfect. Liberals, conservatives, Democrats, Republicans, makes no difference. Nobody thinks the world is perfect. If we don't think it's perfect, then it's our responsibility to work to repair it, right? That's a very powerful concept, and it's a deeply Jewish concept. I remember speaking, the president of Harvard, at the beginning of every academic year on the first day of classes, gives morning prayers at Memorial Church in the heart of Harvard Yard. And I remember one of my last times I did this, you know, it's a 5-minute homily, if you will, a set of remarks. I talked about our tradition of argument. I talked about why it is that we study our sacred texts, we do it in pairs. I talked about why it is that when you read the Talmud, you see represented in the margins the debates of the scholars over the ages, that we have this tradition of questioning, of dialogue, of arguing, that's deeply rooted in who we are as a people. And I think I am optimistic because I still believe out of that dialectic, whether or not it's between two Jews who differ, and we always differ, or others, that good will come of it eventually. And like my mother, if my mother could be optimistic in the face of what she lived through, I think we can be optimistic as well. I find inspiration from her.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for your countless work and for, you know, telling your story professionally and personally and strengthening us and giving us hope.
Well, it's my privilege and honor to have this conversation with you, Shira. Thank you for your kind words. And thank you also for all the good work that you and Jay are doing to repair the world.
Thank you. תודה רבה שהייתם איתי בעוד פרק של הדודים מאמריקה. וכמובן תודה לצוות הנפלא, טל אלפקס, דניאל רוטמן, ליאת דולונגביץ', אבי בליקי. הדודים מאמריקה.